Hi, this is Gordon Deal. The award-winning Wall Street Journal This Morning starts right after this.
Leaving the country on business takes a lot of planning. Bringing your data plan doesn't. With T-Mobile's Simple Choice for Business plan, you'll get unlimited data in over 100 countries automatically. There's no changing plans and no extra charges. Just get off the plane and go. Only at T-Mobile.
Qualifying service and capable device required. Standard speeds approximately 128 kilobytes per second. No tethering. See T-Mobile.com for full feature terms and included destinations.
By 2025, it's estimated that half the world's population will lack access to safe drinking water. A sorry state of affairs as two-thirds of our planet is covered by water. We are helping develop solutions for salt water to satisfy the thirst of future generations. BASF, the chemical company.
Direct from the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal This Weekend with Gordon Deal.
Heart tests for young athletes. I'm Gordon Deal with Gina Cervetti. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
The cardiology community says it's not cost-effective, but parents want to know if their kids should be getting screened for heart problems.
How big investors like pension funds and endowments have missed the big stock rally. Where did they go wrong?
With the Luis Suarez biting incident making so much news at the World Cup, we'll have a list of soccer's biggest villains.
And the problems men have with putting on cologne.
If someone is saying to you, you smell really nice, or what are you wearing, that might not be a compliment. If they can detect it from wherever they're standing, especially if they're standing, you know, a foot away from you or within arm's reach of you, if they can smell you, that probably means that you have on too much.
Wall Street Journal reporter Ray Smith has guidance on where and how to apply cologne. He's here later in the hour. Question for you, is a return to a sound dollar and a new gold standard vital to a healthy global economy? Steve Forbes, editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine, is out with a new book called Money, How the Destruction of the Dollar Threatens the Global Economy and What We Can Do About It. He's with us now to discuss it. He's on the T-Mobile hotline. Steve, how do you see this?
The dollar is right now a little better than it was a couple of years ago, but it's still on a long-term slide. And the reason we wrote this book, Money, on the subject of the decline of the dollar is that it's just a matter of time before we get another economic crisis. The dollar's declined 80% since 1971, and is a critical reason why median incomes are stagnant and why it takes now two incomes in a family to do a middle-class, enjoy middle-class existence, whereas one income could have done it a couple of generations ago.
All right. So explain kind of the ABCs of currency in this picture. We know this matters. I'm just not clear about kind of the rise and fall and what it does.
Well, money simply measures value the way scales measure weight, the way rulers measure length, and the way clocks measure time. And it should have a fixed value. And for 180 years till the early 1970s, the dollar was fixed to gold. Gold was like a ruler. It kept the value of the dollar constant and enabled investments for the future. We went off the gold standard, had a terrible decade in the 70s. Didn't do too badly in the 80s and 90s when the dollar was had a semi-fixed value to gold at roughly $350 an ounce. Not good, but not bad. Then about 12 years ago, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department went off the rails, devalued the dollar. We got the housing bubble, and we've got the crisis of 08 and 09, 2008, 2009, and we've been trying to dig out ever since.
So if we reestablish this, then who gets hurt? I assume somebody will take a haircut, if not immediately, in the long term, perhaps?
99% of the economy would do much better than it is today, and incomes would start to rise again, which is what happens when you have stable money. And the only losers would be speculators and perhaps currency traders. When you have fixed money, you don't need currency trading as much as you do when you have unstable money. As you know, currency trading today involves over $3 trillion of volume a day. Tens of thousands of people, smart brains, good brains, on an activity that is really not necessary. necessary.
We're speaking with Steve Forbes, editor-in-chief and also chairman of Forbes Media. He's got a new book called Money: How the Destruction of the Dollar Threatens the Global Economy and What We Can Do About It. If the decision were that easy, I assume it would have been done at this point. Why is it not that simple?
Policymakers have been taught that unstable money and having the Federal Reserve try to goose the economy through monetary policy is the way to go. It's why we went off the gold standard, and experience can be a slow teacher. We had the disaster of the 70s. We had the disaster of the past 12 years, and policymakers are still wedded to policies of the past, just as it took centuries for people to accept the idea that the sun does not revolve around the earth. And these Keynesian notions have a vice-like grip on policymakers, but eventually we think with a book like this, pointing out how really the subject of money, which is shrouded with equations and jargon, is very, very basic and straightforward.
Who's the presidential name that's being tossed around right now who you think would embrace this approach?
Well, certainly Rand Paul, given his genealogy, certainly has an understanding of it. I think other candidates are open to it, and we'll see how that unfolds. And so I'm looking forward to the process. I think you're going to see a movement toward radically simplified tax code as well as sound money, two basic ingredients for getting the economy moving again. The idea that printing up money out of thin air, money represents what people have created in terms of products and services. But the idea that printing up money leads to sustained economic growth is like saying a restaurant doing up more coat checks guarantees more coats. No, it represents a coat. It doesn't create coats.
Thanks, Steve. Steve Forbes, editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine. Again, the book is called Money: How the Destruction of the Dollar Threatens the Global Economy and What We Can Do About It. 12 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Coming up next, the debate over screening our young athlete children for heart problems.
How easy is getting unlimited data outside the U.S. with T-Mobile? Just one step. Turn on your phone. Because with T-Mobile, unlimited global data in over 100 countries is automatically included in your plan at no extra charge. Sounds simple? It is simple. It's the simple choice for business plan, only at T-Mobile.
Qualifying service and capable device required. Standard speeds approximately 128 kilobytes per second. No tethering. See T-Mobile.com for full feature terms and included destinations.
Thanks for being with us. A big question in sports medicine is, should parents of young athletes have their hearts screened? The thinking in mainstream cardiology is that it's not cost-effective, since congenital heart abnormalities kill fewer than 1 in 100. So parents and physicians are starting, in some cases, their own screening centers. Here's Wall Street Journal reporter Kevin Hellicker. Kevin, what's involved in the screening?
It typically involves an electrocardiogram or EKG. Sometimes they also have an echocardiogram, which takes a look at the structure of the heart. And what they're looking for are the congenital defects that lead to a syndrome known as sudden cardiac death in young athletes.
Okay. So I guess the pros of this are fairly obvious. Are there cons to doing this heart screening?
It is the most debated issue in cardiology worldwide. Basically, if you're a parent and you decide you don't want to have your kid screened, then you are in line with the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology. If you decide you want to have your kid's heart scanned, then you are in line with the European Society of Cardiology. So the evidence is such, Gordon, that when these experts look at it, they don't agree. And so I'm not going to like lay it out here to see if you and I can figure it out.
Yeah.
But basically, the risk if you do it is that your kid would get a false positive.
Right.
So in the EKG, they can't even agree on what these percentages are. But on the EKG, the average kid who's flagged as abnormal will have nothing wrong with his heart. So then he has to go through maybe another test or two to determine that it was, in fact, a false positive, and maybe that costs money, and maybe it causes the kid some anxiety.
Sure. You had not only the kid, but the rest of the family, too,
exactly.
Right?
I mean,
yeah, that's a real stressor.
So then on the flip side, kid falls dead, kid who hadn't been known to have any health problems whatsoever suddenly falls dead, and then his parents learn that for a $20 test, they could have detected and treated the condition that killed him.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Kevin Hellicker. How problematic is this, the sudden death these days, Kevin? Is it something that's grown, or is it just something
we're more aware
of? I don't
think there's any indication that it's grown. I'm not sure that we're that aware of it. I guess I would argue that we're not aware enough of it. The one fix that everyone agrees upon is to have an external defibrillator at the playing field.
Yeah.
Those aren't controversial, because when a kid falls dead, there's a window of time there when you have an opportunity to try to bring him back to life. And yet an incredible number of athletic facilities don't have them. And there was a case not long ago where a high school basketball player made the winning shot, was hoisted upon the shoulders of his teammates, and then died. And everybody sort of was scrambling around, not knowing what to do. Somebody finally remembered that there was a defibrillator in the gym, but it turns out its batteries were dead. Oh. The batteries had been beeping for 3 months before they went dead, but nobody heard it because the defibrillator was kept in a locked closet. Now, if you buy one of those things and you put it in a locked closet, then you don't understand the problem. That kind of story, which is not uncommon, certainly argues for more awareness of the problem, whether or not you get screened.
Thanks, Kevin. Wall Street Journal reporter Kevin Hellicker. It's 19 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Time now for Gina Cervetti.
Well, this coming week, we get the June employment reports, and Comerica's Robert Dye says he expects some upbeat numbers.
We've been running fairly warm on the employment side here with some pretty good numbers. My expectation is about 210,000 for the month of June, and that brings the unemployment rate down to 6.2%.
Before the jobs report, we'll watch for separate readings on services and manufacturing, auto sales, and pending home sales. The final tally of first quarter economic growth showed a larger than expected contraction, almost 3%. Meanwhile, our spending rose 0.2% in May as people were cautious. Incomes outpaced spending. The savings rate rose to almost 5% of our income. And the latest jobless claims numbers slipped in the most recent week. Most of us are saving for a rainy day, but almost 70% has saved less than the recommended 6 months' worth of emergency expenses. Bankrate's Greg McBride says people know their shortfalls here, but job situations limit savings ability.
The biggest reason for most people is that their incomes are not going up. They're not going up at a pace that really facilitates them piling a lot of money away.
Well, as you know, you can learn a lot of stuff on Facebook, and now a New York City prosecutor has won a legal battle against the social network, with a judge saying that Facebook was required to hand over user information in a disability fraud investigation. The FAA wants to cut back on the allowable heights of buildings near airports, driven by a need for safe flight paths in case a plane loses power at takeoff. Real estate developers say the plan would hurt property values. Another reality show is in the works. Nashville-based Daredevil Productions says it's looking for singer-songwriters for a new TV show and says it's working with a major TV production company on that show, which will offer a grand prize of an independent record deal and a tour. Should be able to find more at daredevilcasting.com.
All right. Wonder if the popularity of the show Nashville has had something to do with this.
It could be. I think that one's pretty. Have you watched that at all?
I do not.
It seems like it's doing pretty well.
Kelly likes it. Mm-hmm. She likes to watch it. But no, I don't.
Is that Connie Britton? She's a good actress.
And Hayden Panettiere,
yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right, also in that. She's pretty easy on the eyes. 22 minutes after the hour now on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Thanks for being with us. There were four main themes for part of the Google I.O. conference this past week: mobile gaming, automotive, TV, and wearable devices. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group, has some analysis of these trends. Rob, take us through it.
Well, so they're pretty much pulling all the parts together for all their different programs. Everything from mobile, where they're really showcasing that they can provide gaming capability. They use NVIDIA K1 part as kind of their showcase, which is a part that NVIDIA talks about as having similar performance to a desktop graphics processor. I should point out, in automotive and TV, they also talked about NVIDIA kind of being the core of the effort. So behind the scenes, NVIDIA was getting a lot of love. And then for the television, really organized the way it probably should have been to begin with, a 10-foot experience, auto search on the programs you want to watch, a much better organization, much better connection to your Google devices, tablets, and phones. So a massively improved experience. This, as I say, this is the way it probably always should have been. And by the way, I think even though there were a couple of companies putting this capability in the TV, you probably should have this outboard, because they're cycling their products about once every 6 weeks, which suggests that if you put it in the television, that component's probably going to be obsolete in a year or so.
Yeah.
And if you have a set-top box instead, then it's a lot less painful to change out the set-top box than it is to change out the entire television.
This recycling pattern that you've talked about, is it too quick of a pace, or is it just the nature of technology and innovation today?
Well, we'll see. 6 weeks is actually pretty quick. The thing is I think most of the changes we're going to see in a six-week cadence will be pretty small.
Okay.
So much like Apple typically annually brings out a refresher of their operating system, and a lot of us thought that was, you know, way the hell too fast. It actually held up relatively well with Apple users, and when you're connected to the cloud, when you're connected to the internet, and everything's coming in over the web, you can kind of maintain a much higher cadence. We'll see. It depends on how much they change, how quickly. People could tire of the interface is changing very rapidly, of course, because they'd have to continue to relearn it.
Yeah,
but as
yeah.
long as most of what they're doing is simply improving, they're taking feedback and making changes based on that feedback, it could work out. Now, when I say taking feedback, Google's kind of famous for not taking feedback.
Okay.
So that's where we run into this potential quagmire for them. If they could easily go 1, 2, 3, 6 generations of products to the away from where customers want them to go, and suddenly find themselves off in some eddy someplace, and that, of course, would make Microsoft, Apple, or anybody else that's competing with them very happy. So there probably lies the danger. They don't have the deepest history in terms of listening to what customers want, either the hardware OEMs or end users. And when you're running that fast, if you get pointed in the wrong direction, you go a long way in the wrong direction before things got corrected.
Mm. All right, so we're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle about the Google I/O. Of these four subject areas that you mentioned, automotive, mobile gaming, TV, wearable devices, in your opinion, which one do you think has the potential for the most widespread change or most recognizable change among consumers?
Well, that's actually a really excellent question. Probably wearable devices, because that would be visible on everybody. We didn't talk about some of the other stuff they're doing. They showcased watches, but they're clearly doing Google Glass as well. And that category of product, since it would be attached to everybody and probably be a bridge to embedded technology, in other words, having people surgically implant certain technology, probably have the biggest long-term impact, primarily because, as I say, it leads to embedded technology, and then you could have, you know, artificial eyes, artificial ears, that kind of thing would be enhanced here. And, of course, a couple of people mentioned they're supposedly working on tiny robots that could be injected into your bloodstream and do reparative work. And, of course, they've got a lot of drone technology that could be downsized. So it does look like they're actually working on that next step, this idea of actually implanting technology in you. And so the wearable side is the closest to that and would undoubtedly have the biggest impact on the human race.
Wow. Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle in San Jose. 30 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal This Weekend.
Traveling overseas for business comes with a checklist of things to worry about. But with T-Mobile, you can take getting international data off that list. Because with the Simple Choice for Business plan, unlimited data in over 100 countries is automatically included at no extra charge. Only at T-Mobile.
Qualifying service and capable device required. Standard speeds approximately 128 kilobytes per second. No tethering. See T-Mobile.com for full feature terms and included destinations.
When I was pregnant, I got more advice than I knew what to do with. What I needed was information I could trust on how to take care of me and my baby. Luckily, United Healthcare has a simple program that helps moms stay on track with their doctors and get the right care and guidance before and after the baby is born. Simple is good right now.
Innovations that work for you. That's health in numbers. United Healthcare.
Hey, thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal alongside Gina Cervetti. Coming up this half hour, the World Cup's all-time biggest villains. Yeah, guess where Uruguay's Luis Suarez now ranks? Duh. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. The nation's pension funds and endowments have missed out on much of the huge rally for stocks since 2009 after a push to diversify into other investments following the financial crisis. More from Wall Street Journal reporter Greg Zuckerman. Greg, what have you found?
So it's an interesting phenomenon. It's not just pensions, but it's also the nation's endowments, universities, everybody from Harvard on down. All these big institutions have shifted out of stocks, not entirely, but a large chunk of their money has gone from stocks elsewhere to things like what we call alternatives investments, and that's hedge funds and private equity and venture capital, and even as everyone else's mutual funds have done really well.
Wow. All right. So is this, what, a lesson in trying to time the market? Is this pension funds, endowments, and the like who went too conservative when things went sour several years ago, or what?
Well, it's a long-term phenomenon. It's gone on for over a decade. It just did continue after the financial crisis. Some people said those investments, these alternatives, hedge funds, venture capital, et cetera, they did quite well during the downturn, believe it or not. So a lot of institutions are more risk-averse than you would think, or maybe more risk-averse than they should be, and they kept pouring money from stocks into these investments. And no one really realized how much the market would rebound. I guess the lesson here is when stocks are really cheap, like they were in 2009, you stick with them. And now actually is a decent time to be in things like hedge funds because stocks are more expensive. But they also got caught up in this whole rush towards sexy hedge funds and such, I would argue. And maybe they went overboard.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Greg Zuckerman. He's got a story about how pension funds and endowments and the like missed out on the big stock market rally of the past few years. So is there a change afoot now, or are these holding patterns likely to continue?
Good question. You're hearing some rumblings here and there about an institution that decided they have too much. The problem is they take forever to make decisions. So a pension fund will have a meeting, and then they'll form a committee, and the committee will report back. And by the time they actually make a decision, the market has changed, and stocks aren't quite as expensive or as cheap as they used to be. And you don't want these institutions timing things. I mean, these are institutions that have long time horizons, years and years and decades. So that's why they argue, well, we have to take our time. But as a result, you often make decisions that kind of are a little slow. So, yeah, they've missed out. The market has gone up over 100% since 2009. And if you're an endowment with only, 15% of your money in U.S. stocks, you suffered.
Any examples of, say, some sort of fund that suffered a lot because of this change? I mean, they all made money, I presume, just not as much as they could have.
Exactly. I mean, Harvard, Stanford, Yale, they've underperformed over the last 5 years, but they've outperformed over the past decade because holding a lot of alternatives, pension funds and such, helped them out a lot in 2008. So there's a trade-off. You don't want to be overly critical of these guys because long-term sometimes makes sense.
Are there lessons here for the rest of us?
Yeah, it's a cliche, but having a 60-40 portfolio, or at least a mix in your portfolio of both stocks, bonds, and if you can afford it, hedge funds and pension funds, that's the best route as opposed to shifting. But also, when stocks are cheap, like they were in 2009, you stick with stocks. And when things get expensive, as they're getting nowadays, you take some money off the table and you have them more in cash or in some alternative type investments. It sounds really simple, but you'd be surprised people get caught up in the moment.
Thanks, Greg. Wall Street Journal reporter Greg Zuckerman. 22 minutes now before the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Coming up next, why this is the summer for you if you like ballet.
We help farmers make the best use of their land, which means healthier crops, higher yields, and less harvesting hours, which is good news for a growing population. And good news for the environment. BASF, the chemical company.
Sorry. Do you like ballet? Well, then this is your kind of summer. Wall Street Journal arts reporter Pia Catton says it's an unusually rich season. She joins us from New York. Pia, what's going on this year?
You know, ballet can sometimes get some criticism for being like a niche art form or elitist or esoteric. But from what we're seeing, a lot of people are going to the ballet.
Okay.
So New York every spring has two major companies, New York City Ballet and American Ballet Theater. But in addition, Lincoln Center Festival typically brings in dance companies. This year, they're bringing in the Bolshoi Ballet, which is really one of the best, most important dance companies, certainly one of the oldest in the world. In addition, the fact that the Koch Theater has, in the last 2 years, begun presenting much more dance, and they are also bringing in higher level performances, this time by Boston Ballet. So right now we have on stage in New York, at Lincoln Center, American Ballet Theater and Boston Ballet. Shortly we're going to have the Bolshoi, and we just had New York City Ballet. I mean, it's kind of unbelievable. You know, you look at this and you think, how much ballet can New York City sustain?
All right, so I'm feeling the ballet fatigue already. To what do we owe this?
It's really a confluence of factors. Lincoln Center Festival typically brings in good performances and good companies, but it just so happens this year is really top-notch. And in addition, the Koch Theater, when it lost New York City Opera, created a 15-week gap that it had to fill. So the loss of that opera company meant it had to fill that theater with something. Mm. So it turned out dance was the answer, because that stage is typically used as the home for New York City Ballet.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Pia Cadden. How important is ballet to the New York City art scene?
It's quite important, and studies have shown that the economic impact of dance in all of its genres really contributes not only economic activity with the fact of people buying tickets and going out to eat and all that. It employs a ton of people. I'm sorry I don't have the numbers with me, but it's an art form whose participants are growing, and the numbers there actually reflect that very small companies, startups, are thriving in New York City.
That's good, yeah.
It's true. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where you have a choreographer who decides, I'm going to put together a small company, and you get all your dancers together and go with that.
I'm curious, too, is this kind of explosion in ballet this summer a sign of the economy, that things are doing better?
It could be. And look, all those companies have reported to me, well, most of them, I should say, reported to me that their sales were either sold out or strong, or, you know, that they had seen an increase in the ticket sales over last season.
Okay.
So people have their discretionary income and they're spending it.
Thanks, Pia. Wall Street Journal arts reporter Pia Cadden from New York. 16 minutes now before, by the way, my daughter would support the whole snoring thing I did at the beginning of that segment. She's a dancer and does not care for ballet. 16 minutes now in front of the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Coming up next, what us guys are doing wrong with cologne.
A smartphone is a pretty harmless device, unless you take one outside the U.S. without T-Mobile. Binging quietly on emails and GPS coordinates, it might run your data tab into the thousands. Smart business travelers choose T-Mobile's Simple Choice for Business plan, with unlimited global data in over 100 countries at no extra charge.
Qualifying service and capable device required. Standard speeds approximately 128 kilobytes per second. No tethering. See T-Mobile.com for full feature terms and included destinations.
Thanks for being with us. Men tend to put on too much cologne. While their intentions are good, the results, as you know, can be, well, overpowering. As part of that, some men's fragrance designers are increasingly launching lighter versions of their colognes for summer. Meanwhile, men are generally clueless on not only how to apply cologne, but also how much, even where. For guidance, here's Wall Street Journal reporter Ray Smith. Ray, I suspect if you have to ask if you're putting on too much, you probably did.
And that's a good read, actually. If someone is saying to you, you smell really nice, or what are you wearing, that might not be a compliment. If they can detect it from wherever they're standing, especially if they're standing, you know, a foot away from you or within arm's reach of you, if they can smell you, that probably means that you have on too much.
Or if you're on the phone, right, and you can smell them, that's too much, too much. So how do you know, though? What's the right amount? Is it one, you know, one squirt of the bottle, or one dab on the fingertip, on the neck? What do you do?
It turns out that you don't need to spray on a lot in order to smell fine or to smell nice. And so it's really hard to tell, but you kind of don't have to overdo it. You should get away with a couple of spritzes, especially if it's a heavier fragrance. The less spritzes for a heavier fragrance. What I mean by heavier, something like with dark notes or woody notes or amber, or even things that smell like vanilla or very sweet. sweet or musky, that carries far. So you really don't have to put too much of those kinds of fragrances on. But during summer, there are a lot of changes in fragrances on the market. There's a whole sort of group of summer fragrances, and some of them even have the name summer on the label. And those are characterized by notes that are more citrusy or marine. They sort of smell like evoke the ocean. And those you can spray a little bit more on because those notes tend to evaporate quicker. In general, it is really hard to know.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Ray Smith about how much cologne is too much. So another application question, I guess. Should it go on your shirt or should you spray it on, say, directly on your skin?
Both. So, several people told me that it's a good idea to spray it on your clothes, and that's primarily because it'll linger on the clothes in a good way, and it also won't damage your clothes. And plus, when you put it back in your closet, if you're not going to dry clean it immediately, it's going to make the closet smell good too. But it has a way of lingering on the body, even more so than on the skin, because it evaporates off the skin quicker. But you should also apply on your neck, you know, a little bit on your wrist. I wouldn't go overboard on the chest, but you can spray a little bit on the chest. And some people even recommend spraying on the hair because the follicles absorb some of the fragrance oil, and that helps to keep the fragrance on you longer.
What would you say is the percentage of men who apply the wrong amount of cologne?
I don't know off the top of my head. I can only say anecdotally that people do complain more about men over-applying than women do.
I'll go back to my initial term of clueless. Thanks, Ray. Wall Street Journal reporter Ray Smith. So, a quick survey here. 100% of men involved with this program do not spray cologne on their hair.
Oh, okay.
I never heard that before.
Okay, well, now, what is that smell then, I wonder?
It's just called male, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Male.
I got it.
M-A-L-E.
Let's package that and see if we can't sell that, huh?
9 minutes now in front of the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Once again, here's Gina Cervetti.
All right. Well, this next week we get the June jobs report, and that's on Friday. But between now and then, we will watch for other reports, one on the services part of the economy and also a separate one on manufacturing. We have auto sales numbers and those from pending home sales.
We did see some April numbers ticking up a little bit. My expectation is we continue to see a little bit of firming on the home sales front as traditional buyers come back into the market.
Robert Dye is with Comerica. The May existing home sales showed an increase of about 5%, while sales of new homes were up just over 4.5%, marking their fastest pace in 6 years, led by a surge in the Northeast.
These winter months that you've heard economists saying were really, really a big drag on the economy and especially in the housing sector. You know, people weren't going out and looking at homes. You know, it was too cold. We're starting to see that crop up.
Joe Doe is with the streets. It's almost the case where we've reached the point of not being able to go anywhere without our devices. You know, you have that panicked feeling when you think for a fleeting moment that maybe you left it at home. Well, Consumer Reports says that, in fact, 63% of travelers take their smartphones on vacation. Half brings the laptop. And we cart an average of 3 devices every time we go on vacation. If you want to buy a cool new car with the cool price of less than $18,000, then there are some good choices, as compiled by KBB.com. And at the top is the Mazda 3, followed by the Hyundai Veloster, and then the Kia Soul, all 2014 models. All right, think twice before you post. Career Builder says that, in fact, around half of employers that checked a job seeker on social media to see what they've been doing there saw something that torpedoed the person's job chances, and that's up from last year.
1/3 of employers who researched candidates on social networking sites said they've actually found content that made them more likely to hire that candidate. Nearly 1/4 said they found content that led them to directly hire that candidate.
Career Builder's Jennifer Grass. Topping the list, though, of the things you don't want to put up there that might kill the chance you're getting a job: inappropriate photos or posts about drinking or using drugs.
You know what's interesting? Those numbers are high, obviously, that she was giving, but those are for employers who actually checked.
Right.
The percentage of those who check, I thought, was higher, but it's not. I've seen conflicting things now that say just not a lot do it at all, which surprises me.
You wouldn't be able to check somebody if they had their settings on private.
Right.
I mean, it would be kind of tough to see. But
plenty of people on my, you know, I'm friends with or I'm not friends with, don't have them on private. It's amazing.
Yeah, people put them on public and then anybody can look at it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Gina. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on the Wall Street Journal This Weekend. Next, where Luis Suarez now ranks on the list of all-time World Cup villains.
By 2025, it's estimated that half the world's population will lack access to safe drinking water. A sorry state of affairs as two-thirds of our planet is covered by water. We are helping develop solutions for salt water to satisfy the thirst of future generations. BASF, the chemical company.
Unfortunately, a fantastic World Cup has taken a back seat to the attention given to the Luis Suarez biting incident. That said, Bleacher Report came up with a list of the World Cup's worst villains. For sinking his teeth into an Italian player, Suarez found himself as the number one villain on the list. Number two is Argentina's Diego Maradona, who scored a goal versus England in 1986 called the Hand of God. He knocked in a goal with his hand, trying to make it appear that he had used his head. Considered one of the most infamous acts of deception. Number three, Frank Rijkaard of the Netherlands, spitting not once but twice in the hair of West Germany's Rudi Völler in 1990. Speaking of West Germany, they make the World Cup villains list at number five as an entire team for their mess in 1982 when they conspired to beat Austria just 1-0 so both teams would advance and Algeria would be sent home. Want a modern-day connection? Current U.S. coach Jurgen Klinsmann, number 17 on the list of World Cup villains, 1990 versus Argentina, his antics after a foul made it appear part breakdance, part mini-convulsion. The guy who fouled him got red-carded. For Gina Cervetti, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to the Wall Street Journal This Weekend.